This is the time set for oral argument for the Southern Panel of the Supreme Court in two cases, Joshua Kramer and versus the State of Nevada Department of Motor Vehicles, and the same department versus Claudette Joseph, cases 53248 and 53380. The Kramer case will be taken up first. Mr. Watkins, Ms. Waters, you're ready to proceed?
Yes, sir. Okay. Justice Hardesty, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
The Kramer issue raises two issues. The first issue, are we going to allow the Department of Motor Vehicle to dispense with the requirement to show that a person has been qualified and competent to test blood? The second issue is the two-hour violation. So I'm going to address them in that sequence first. I don't believe anyone could say that we do not want to have accurate scientific testing in a particular case. At the Department of Motor Vehicles, we know that that's dispositive of taking away someone's license and alcohol level. In this particular case, with alcohol testing, there's that human element that's involved. Not so much a machine, okay? Now, someone has to know how to operate a machine, but you also have someone who's preparing the samples, et cetera. So there's a human element in every scientific testing. And as a result of that, it is required that the person be qualified and competent to do the testing, in this case, the blood testing.
Mr. Watkins, are you asserting that that qualification should take place at that hearing or pursuant to the statute, who has qualified the district court of any county to testify? Is that sufficient?
There's two ways that you would show whether someone's been qualified and competent to do scientific testing. One is the usual way, and that's cross-examination. And the legislature in 5320 had made a compromise. You know, they realized that, you know, it's difficult to get people to come down to these various hearings, et cetera. So what they said, they didn't dispense with the requirement that you have a showing that someone is in fact qualified to do the testing. And so what they did in their compromise, they said, as long as an individual has been first qualified in district court as an expert, then that person can submit a declaration or affidavit and does not have to appear. By the way, this case, 5320, also applies to preliminary hearings and also grand jury proceedings. This one happens to be a Department of Motor Vehicle matter. What happened in this case, the ALJ did not in any way object to the language. There's no question as to what 5320 says. It's very clear. If a person has been first qualified as an expert in district court, then the declaration or affidavit is, in fact, the statute says, must be admitted at the Department of Motor Vehicles. So there's no question with that language. What happened was the ALJ, who's not a lawyer, came up with a unique finding. And by the way, I've been doing DMVs for 30 years. This issue, we've never had a problem with this issue. If the person was not qualified, then what they did, they contacted the person on the phone, and then you'd have a telephonic conversation and have an opportunity to cross-examine. It's just the result of this one particular administrative law judge, again, who's not a lawyer, that came up with this solution to allow the 50.320 declaration to be admitted, even though the condition for admissibility has not been satisfied. And here's what the ALJ said, and that's on page 5 of my brief. Neither this nor any other statute or regulation prohibits the admission of an affidavit or declaration of a person not formally qualified by a district court. The implication that admission is precluded if the declarant has not been formally qualified is a misstatement of what NRS 50.320 provides. And then I give you the cite that the ALJ said. The mistake here is that the ALJ didn't understand the rule of statutory construction. The exclusion of one thing, or the statement, the expression of one is the exclusion of another. The ALJ says, well, this only deals with if someone's been qualified. But if they're not qualified, then we have discretion to admit the document itself. And that is clearly in violation of the rules of statutory construction. It violates common sense as well. This document was not admissible at the Department of Motor Vehicles. To allow a document to be admissible without any showing that the person's been qualified or competent in the blood testing is contrary to common sense and the intent of the legislature.
Just to be clear, Mr. Watkins, for clarification,
sure.
And part of the reason for this oral argument was to clarify the record. So my question on this point is, it's my understanding that there was nothing outside of the affidavit to qualify this expert.
No, there was not.
My understanding is the ALJ's position was, while the statute compels me to accept the affidavit in circumstances in which it's presented by a chemist or an expert who's been qualified in district court, it doesn't prevent me from admitting an affidavit on a discretionary basis.
Correct.
The question is whether the affidavit was the sole basis for qualifying this expert.
It was.
Okay.
There's no question about that.
All right. The expert, Cypra or...
Cypra?
Pardon me?
It's Michael Cypra.
Yeah.
Yes.
Didn't appear.
Oh, no.
Didn't testify. Okay. I just want to be sure that my understanding of the record was correct.
No. The next issue is the two-hour rule. And the reason that this was raised in my case in Weaver, the court made a statement that in Hyatt, we determined that it's the level at the time of the test, so long as it's within 2 hours.
On this point, I need clarification of the record as well.
Okay.
In the Kramer case. Was Kramer charged with DUI in connection with the accident at the apartment complex, or was he charged with DUI returning to the scene to explain to the officer what had happened? It would seem like there would be a time period that would impact the two-hour test.
He was charged at the time of the accident and not the time to come back. Because
he did drive himself back, as I understood it.
Yes.
Okay. And he wasn't charged with DUI for that vehicular driving.
And he was told to come back. And so it would be really unfair and probably illegal to arrest him for DUI when you told him to come back. But
it might be unfair, but it might not be illegal. But I want to know which of the two events was the subject of the charge.
At the collision.
Okay. And is it correct, and I'll ask Ms. Waters to comment on this too, but is it correct that the test that was taken was well more than 2 hours after the accident in the apartment complex?
Yes, sir. Okay. 13 minutes.
Huh?
It was 13 minutes after the 2 hours.
Okay.
And I put that in a footnote in my opening brief.
Yeah. And then that's what I thought. But then the next question was this, did the affidavit connect the test? The affidavit only expressed the level of alcohol at the time of the test.
Yes, sir.
Nothing in the affidavit connected the level of alcohol either in the two-hour period or at the time of the accident.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I understand I at least understand the facts from what the record shows.
And I'd just like to say
but
that
your argument is that Weaver says, reading Hyatt, that the test must be taken within 2 hours.
That the two-hour rule did apply, yes.
Okay. Well, in effect, you're reading the two-hour rule as being a requirement that the test be taken within 2 hours.
Yes, and the reason...
My hypothetical is this.
Yes.
Is there anything that would preclude satisfaction of the statute if the test is taken more than 2 hours, the expert or an expert opines that the test result would support a conclusion that the blood alcohol level is above the legal limit within the two-hour period, and the defendant doesn't offer any evidence to show alcohol consumption as discussed in Weaver after the accident occurred.
At the time, dealing with strictly with a Department of Motor Vehicle issue, okay, because we have a criminal process in a DMV. There's a distinction between the two, because one of the theories in a criminal prosecution is that it has to be within 2 hours.
Right.
So under the language of the statute for the DMV, it would be inappropriate to try to relate back to the time of the driving, because the law says the time of the test. And timing is important, because prior to having the two-hour rule, the court has always said that if, you know, the timing of getting a test is important, because the longer it goes, the less reliable it is. Mm-hmm. And in Breaux, which was one of my cases, I have a bunch of these cases, not all favorable either, but in Breaux, they said 5 hours was just too much time. Now, in Weaver, they put it down to the 2 hours, and I think it's very reasonable to have the two-hour rule. And so, clearly, the test is taken.
But you're advocating in revocation cases that the test must be taken in 2 hours.
Yes.
Okay.
I think with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time if I need it.
Do you want to discuss the Joseph case while you're up, just in the interest of time?
Sure, sure. I'd be more than
do
happy.
Do you object to doing so?
No.
I don't.
No, I do not object at all. I'm totally familiar with these. I live with these cases.
We have additional time, obviously, and so we might as well get both of them addressed if you don't mind approaching it that way.
I have no problem, Justice Hardesty. The Joseph case is very important, because now it tells us what type of qualification is necessary. And after I wrote these, they came out with the Higgs case, which is really a nice, well-reasoned opinion, and it talks about that 50.275 is the basis for determining the qualification of an expert witness. And in Joseph, what transpired, first off, we always battle with these affidavits at the Department of Motor Vehicles, because people put in there that they have, in fact, been qualified, et cetera, and on the face of the document, it looks like everything's fine. In fact, Teresa Suffolk in the Joseph case, in her affidavit, if you look at it, facially says she's qualified. She was qualified on September 25th of 2007. I try to do my homework. I try to represent my clients zealously within the bounds of the law. And so I found out what this qualification was, and it turned out that Tony Lacker and Bruce Nelson got together in a case and stipulated without any testimony by a district court judge, etc. And that was the basis for Ms. Suffolk stating that she was, in fact, qualified. And so I was able to get a copy of that stipulation, which was introduced at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Also, Ms. Suffolk was cross-examined by John Spilatro in a different case, and I believe it was the same ALJ that we had in Kramer. But during that cross-examination, the ALJ actually found that Ms. Suffolk wasn't qualified. She really didn't know much about how to do the testing. And so in this case, what my position was is that what is the definition of qualification? And qualification of an expert has to come under 50.275. And that's what this court said in Higgs, which really backed up. Now, I didn't have Higgs when I made my argument, but Higgs backs my position up. And in this case, a stipulation without any factual determination of qualifications is inappropriate. Stipulation could not bind anyone. And should not bind. There was no showing that, in fact, Ms. Suffolk was qualified. In fact, there was every showing that she was not, in fact, qualified. So that's, and these two cases kind of dub each other here, because one is what is required. You need to show that a person has been, this is Kramer, you need to show that a person has, in fact, been qualified as an expert. First qualified. If they're first qualified, the affidavit comes in. And keep in mind, this requirement goes for the preliminary hearing and for the grand jury. So it's really...
Mr. Watkins, under that where we're at right now, because I know sometimes it's difficult, if you have someone who's on the stand, one party or the other attempts to qualify, the other party stands up and says, I'll stipulate after certain things have been introduced, their education, their experience, and so on. Is that good enough then, under the 50.275?
It may
or,
be.
And that's what I was coming
to. Yeah, it may
in some
be.
Cases, depending on on counsel, another counsel would say, no, there are questions I needed to ask because I don't think they were, in fact, qualified. I wouldn't have stipulated.
Sure. So I believe that you know, under those circumstances you may very well have, because you have a, you know, a question and answer session going on where a judge can make the determination, is the person qualified? And in this case, there was none of that.
Right.
And so that was the problem. And it's very difficult to get a district court judge to agree on a DMV matter, but Judge Denton agreed on this one and said, no, this is not appropriate, this stipulation. We really don't know whether people are qualified. And again, that's kind of the quintessential issue here, is are we going to dispense with the requirement of having people who are doing scientific testing, in this case blood testing, are we going to dispense with the requirement to show that they are qualified and competent? If we did, it would violate the language of 50.320 for sure. And there's no difficulty in providing this information. If someone is not qualified, the Department of Motor Vehicles can, in fact, do telephonic witnesses. There's no problem. It's and then once you're first qualified, then that's all you need. So there's no burden here. And in the Kramer case, when the ALJ turns around and comes up with, well, this only deals with if someone's qualified. Again, that she just didn't understand. And I say this respectfully. I'm not here in any way bad-mouthing anybody below. We all make mistakes. But sometimes not legally trained people come up with some stuff. And this one was that, well, this only applied if they were qualified. And since they're not qualified, then we can, in fact, use our discretion to admit it. And that's incorrect. So, with that, I'm asking that you grant my appeal on Kramer on two issues. One is that, again, the 5320 declaration was inadmissible because it did not meet the statutory requirement of first qualified in district court. And I ask that you uphold the Joseph case on the grounds that there was no showing that Ms. Supical was, in fact, qualified to administer the blood testing in this case, because the extent of the qualification was based upon the stipulation from Mr. Liker and Mr. Nelson without any colloquy as to was this person qualified or not. And I think it's very dispositive to take a look at the decision where John Spilatro did the cross-examination, did a nice job, cross-examination of Ms. Supical, and the ALJ found that based upon that cross-examination, she was, in fact, not qualified. And that was all right around the same time here. So,
are you still pursuing your position, Joseph, as to issues not in the record before the administrative law judge?
No. I think we have, you know, they're pretty straightforward, and I just ask that the law be followed. And with that,
okay.
All right. Down, unless you have anything else.
Any questions for Mr. Watkins? All right. Ms. Waters, good morning.
Good morning.
And I'll ask you the same question. Do you mind arguing these two cases together?
I don't. I can go from one to the other. I'm just a little unclear how the timing would work then.
Well, we have plenty of time, and so just rock and roll.
Okay. May it please the court. Good morning. In addressing the Kramer case first, I would just want to start off by reminding the court of its long history in these DMV revocation hearings and how different they are from the criminal proceedings. And I know a couple of questions were asked of Mr. Watkins from the criminal standpoint, which I understand. But the DMV, again, is never made privy to that that proceeding because they're always kept separate. And in the Weaver case, which I think Justice Hardesty, you were on that panel, mm-hmm. said the court has carved out a unique posture. And I think that's something that permeates the theme of DUI driver's revocation cases the entire time all the way through, going back into the early 80s. So for the last 20 or 30 years, the court has always carved out this unique posture towards these cases, with the goal being to protect the public from irresponsible drivers. So it's against that backdrop that I address these two cases. One of the statutes that we haven't talked about yet is 233B. I mean, that's the Administrative Procedures Act that governs these cases. While we're talking about 5320 in part, that, of course, governs all cases, criminal, civil, and even administrative. But only 233B could never be applied to a criminal case, mind you, But in an administrative procedures case, that's what governs. And it says, it provides that evidence may be admitted, except where precluded by statute, if it is of a type commonly relied upon by reasonable and prudent persons in the conduct of their affairs. And I know counsel has always kind of addressed that, except as otherwise precluded by statute. So I'll get to that in a second. But in looking what type of evidence is for reasonable and prudent persons, you have the police officer who's going to use the affidavit of the chemist to then go ahead and issue a certification of cause to revoke that person's driver's license. Is an affidavit by a chemist reasonable? Well, it is when you look at those cases.
Well, counsel, that's one of the threshold questions. It calls for someone who's been declared by affidavit a chemist or someone who's been qualified. And the question we have in the cases before us is whether or not that those specific declarations were made within that statute.
Under 15320.
Did they indicate that the person was a chemist, number one, or in the other case, are we talking about someone who's been qualified in the district court?
Okay. Let me kind of step back, I guess, to answer the question. Under 5320, it is a statute of mandatory inclusion. If you have an affidavit where the person says, I have been qualified in the district court, which now says it's been amended, and now says any court, but at the time of this, it's a district court. If you have someone who has been qualified as an expert witness, I mean, people are experts before they get a chance to be a witness, but if they have been qualified as an expert witness, then their affidavit must be admitted into the hearing. But it is, while it's, a statute of mandatory inclusion, it is not a statute of preclusion. When you go back to an administrative hearing, which allows for evidence to be admitted if it's reasonable. And in administrative cases, not just driver's license cases, but all administrative hearings, lots of evidence comes in and it becomes a weight argument. You know, it's all admissible, items are received, and then it's a weight issue. In the cases in Nevada, when you look at blood testing, this court has said over and over and over again how reliable it is. And these are just some of the quotes I wanted to bring up this morning. Again, going back into the 80s, blood analysis is considered to be one of the most reliable methods of blood alcohol testing, State v. Hall. In DeRosa, an affidavit for blood analysis possesses particularized guarantees of trustworthiness such that cross-examination would add little to its reliability. The affiants are trained professionals who have motive to lie or fabricate.
But that's the question. How do we know they're trained professionals if they don't meet, say, the standard that's put forth in 5320 as a gatekeeping situation?
Well, right. I understand what you're saying. And there are certain things, I guess,
that we're talking about, in essence, you're talking about a summary proceeding opposed to opening it up for a full evidentiary or even in an administrative setting having sufficient evidence for the trier of fact to make a decision based upon facts before them.
Right. And that's what's, I guess, been unique about the procedure of the administrative hearing, and particularly in this case. I mean, there are certain things with respect to this affiant that were known to the DMV, I think, that are not in this record, so I'm not going to go into things that weren't in this record. I'm not going to talk about things that I may know of that aren't in the record before you. However, when you look at the procedural posture of this case, the administrative law judge introduced those exhibits. She said, counsel, and it wasn't Mr. Watkins at the time, it was Mr. Tom Connor, who was actually the lawyer below in both these matters, who now actually is the chief administrative law judge at the DMV, so it's a strange twist of events there. In any event, she says, any preliminary matters? He says, no, judge, thank you. Then she goes ahead with the officer and has him, you know, lay the foundation for these documents. When he gets the chemist affidavit, can you tell me about this one? The officer says, yes, that's the affidavit I received that directed me to do the evidentiary cause. There's no objection by counsel at the time to these affidavits. So that's when we get back to sort of City v. Walsh and Bremer and the cases that say, when we talk about a scientific method that is so otherwise reliable, if counsel for the petitioner doesn't object, then it's going to come in.
Does the affidavit, because you keep bouncing on that word chemist, does the affidavit identify this party as a chemist?
I think the affidavit actually said he was a forensic scientist, probably a term used by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. That statute on chemist has now been expanded under 5320 to include basically anybody whose duties it is to do blood testing. But I guess my point is when you when the cases have said that cross-examination without objection is going to be meaningless, then the DMV has met part of its burden of proof, right? There's the burden of proof is the burden of production and the burden of persuasion. The DMV meets its burden of production by saying, here's the affidavit of Michael Stipa.
Well, the
counsel
question,
says no problem.
The question is, when you present that affidavit, has that affidavit met the standards set forth in the statute that calls for certain precise things? If one of those things are missing, does that administrative law judge still have the ability to accept it and disregard the fact that it's missing one of the precursor?
Well, that's only if you find that 5320 is not how we've suggested it to be, that it's a statute of mandatory inclusion, but it doesn't preclude other affidavits and lots of other hearings. You're going to have evidence that comes in, again, just under 233B, because it's just strictly an administrative hearing for a driver's license revocation, and that's where we just got to keep those two things separately, because it's the unique posture for those cases, is you look at 233B. 233B is going to permeate the entire administrative procedure level in all administrative cases.
Well, 233B and the administrative talks about sufficiency of the evidence or errors of law in a nutshell. So it directs us back clearly to having to look at a statute that has not been precluded, which is 5320, that was designed specifically for this type of testing. That's kind of the nut of what we have in front of us.
Well, and that's where I guess you just have to, the DMV would ask the court to look at those distinct differences in these cases on a, kind of the policy that's kind of gone through all the way back to Vezeriz. I mean, Vezeriz is a case going back 24 years. And they talked about the burden of producing an affiant in every single case at a DMV hearing. That's all that person is going to be doing. We want the chemist back in the lab testing
well,
the blood.
And this will clearly allows for it if they follow no different from a chemist doing a blood test, the protocol that's necessary. If you don't follow the protocol, then we have a problem.
Well,
it would appear no different from the chemist doing the blood test. By stating they're a chemist, we think they have the education to do the test, or by saying they're qualified, again, we think they have the education background to do whatever we're supposed to do.
I understand, and I guess that's where the administrative law judge, as a trier of fact, has that duty to ferret it out. And I guess that's the whole point when you go back to an administrative hearing, right, is to get the facts ferreted out. If there's a problem, get them down here, get it out. But when the DMV meets its burden of production by saying, here's the affidavit of the forensic scientist at the Metro Lab, counsel, do you have any problems? No, they've waived that.
Is your point that
50.320
is one vehicle for securing the admission of an expert affidavit, i.e. the person has qualified in another district court case, but you could have another affidavit that establishes a witness who has never before qualified but nonetheless establishes that witness's expert qualifications?
Absolutely.
Is that your point?
Yes.
And did this affidavit independently establish, make a sufficient showing that this witness was in fact qualified, and then the opposing person did not contest the affidavit's verification of qualifications? Is that what your argument is?
It is, absolutely, in a nutshell. Because at the very end, they offer closing. But there's, you know, sufficient times when the evidence is introduced, there's no objections. When it's specifically introduced to the officer, no objections. At the end, you know, when there's time for the closing argument, then there's pages of just a narrative by opposing counsel going, oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's always the hook. I mean, that's kind of the gamesmanship.
So it's a 50.275. In other words, it's independently qualifying as an expert, just not live, but by affidavit.
Well, yeah, and by the fact that they waived any objections to that.
And there was no challenge to it.
Right. Well,
when did the challenge get made?
At the end, at the closing argument.
At the closing argument.
And that's kind of the
Kramer's counsel argued, you can't consider this affidavit because it doesn't set forth sufficient qualifications to support the conclusions reached in the affidavit. They didn't waive it. I mean, the affidavit and its admissibility is one thing, but that wasn't a waiver of the expert's qualifications, was it?
Well,
you seem to be suggesting that by allowing the admission of the affidavit, mm-hmm. there was a waiver of a right to challenge what that evidence could be used for.
Well,
but the argument made clear that they weren't waiving that.
No, in the closing argument, that's true. And I guess what, you know, is the...
So what in the... Let's go to the heart of it.
Okay.
What in the affidavit satisfied the qualifications, satisfied the ALJ on the qualifications of this expert, accepting your argument that 23B generally permits the admissibility of an affidavit and setting aside the waiver question?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What in the affidavit set forth sufficient qualifications for Sterpa to offer the opinion about the results of the blood test?
Well,
or is it your contention that simply because he recites the result, the ALJ could accept the result, whether it was taken by Sterpa or whether it was taken by anybody?
Well,
you're not contending that, are you? That
no,
you can submit an affidavit from Jim Hardesty that says the blood test results are above the legal limit, point whatever. You're not suggesting that should be accepted.
No, I mean, there's not going to be an affidavit from me or you or anybody else who's not a forensic scientist employed by the lab of Metro and reviewed by Tracy Birch, who had been qualified years and years and years ago, who everybody knows is a qualified expert. I mean, she's on the, you know, the reviewed by of his affidavit, combined with, the knowledge that he had testified, I believe, telephonically before. I don't know before this ALJ. I don't want to make those representations.
Well, I'm just talking about...
This
the
case.
Evidence in front of this
right.
ALJ
okay.
is the affidavit.
Right, right. Set against the backdrop of, okay, so he's a forensic scientist. He works at the crime lab. It's his job to do this. It's reviewed by Tracy Birch. And the Supreme Court, I mean, the ALJ knows that the Supreme Court over and over and over and over again has said it's reliable. The blood testing is inherently reliable, where cross-examination would offer very little. But if there was an issue, and that's why I kind of go back to not just the waiver issue, but really if there was an issue, it would have been, let's stop this right here. Yes, I have issues. Of course I've got, I want him down here. I want to subpoena him and I want to have him down here. But that's the gamesmanship that goes on here. It's sit quiet, sit quiet, sit quiet, and then get to district court and go, wait, I have issues. But you don't get that second bite up there when you've sat on your hands the whole time in the administrative hearing.
What did the affidavit say about the qualifications of this affiant to give that expert testimony? Let's get down to it on that.
It's on page...
excuse me.
71?
I have a copy at the end of my opening brief.
Right.
Thank you.
I think it's 71 at the record, but the number was cut off. Okay, so at the top, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Forensic Laboratory Report of Examination. I, Michael Stipe, do hereby declare that I am a forensic scientist employed by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. I received the sealed evidence in the above secure refrigerator in the forensic laboratory containing a sample of whole blood. I compared an analysis of the sample and determined the blood contained a concentration of alcohol of 0.132 grams per 100 milliliters of blood. Seals it again, puts it back in the secure refrigerator, and kept it in his custody. It's signed under penalty of perjury, forensic scientist 2 with his number, reviewed by his manager, Tracy Birch.
Was there any testimony in the record as to who Tracy Birch was? Did the officer give testimony to that?
No, that's just something known within the DMV.
So you're just relying on common knowledge,
yeah.
But outside this record?
That, to answer your question, yes, but I realize that's not in the record. But that's what, you know, could have happened or, you know, and Judge Wall found that to be sufficient. You know, if there was a question, you know, the petitioner could have asked for it to be remanded or, you know, demanded the presence of Michael Stipe. And that they don't do.
The problem, no offense to Judge Wall, understanding his background, is that people appear and they're forensic scientists now under that banner. But sometimes they have a specialty. They are in the chemistry area. Other times they're the fingerprint people. They're the firearms people. That's my problem with that broad topic. And a few are experts in all three areas, but not all of them necessarily are. And I guess that's why just that nomenclature without something else queries you to say, the statute says chemist, are you also a chemist.
And I can understand that you know, you are posing this now. At the administrative hearing, though, I mean, parties are going to stipulate to certain things. When there hasn't been a request by petitioner's counsel to make the arguments that you are making now, to he should have done that below, right? I mean, that's kind of it. When the DMV has met a burden of production.
Was that a stipulation?
Well, I suppose a waiver by not objecting, you're agreeing.
Justice Hardesty pointed out, did he waive it? It was still raised within the confines of the hearing. Argument is part of that hearing.
It's still argument, but it's not the same thing as saying, I do have a problem, I want him here. I want a subpoena that I can have under the NAC procedures to get him down here. That's what I want. That's not done because that's the hook to get to district court, to hopefully convince the district court judge that this is something that should be reweighed and reexamined. It's not, if there's really a problem, get him down here, because otherwise, the Supreme Court has said, look, this is an inherent procedure, let's keep going, because the burdens of, person under due process is entitled to a fair hearing. They're not entitled to a perfect hearing. They're entitled to a fair hearing, right? So that's what it is. And you have to weigh the burdens of bringing down all these affiants against, do you really want to ask some questions? Because really, I would posture that.
Is the burden of bringing them down, or is the burden just forcing the affidavit to be done correctly?
Well, good point. And it's going to be, I suppose, a little bit easier now that it's been district court changed to court of record, right? All the courts of records in Nevada, you only have those few people that are doing all these driver's license cases. People are still going to have to wait. So the flip side of that is, when you look at the Weaver case, where it talked about the burden, there was a burden shifting argument, and the court agreed that it's not shifting the burden, just like it's not here. Once you have a burden of production of this affidavit, it's up to the petitioner's counsel to come back with another proffer that this shouldn't be believed, and then it becomes a persuasion issue. In Weaver, they said, and then that's against the backdrop of how much time and effort is it going to be on the state, who has a substantial interest in keeping the highways of Nevada safe, how much burden are we going to put on the state of Nevada to bring these affiants down versus the burden of persuasion back on the petitioner to say, in this one case, I do have a problem.
Well, the burden is on the state to a certain degree, but we do not want the decisions of the state to be arbitrary and capricious, I guess, the concern.
Understood.
That's a term of argument, 233B.
And that's why you hope it gets ferreted out where it needs to be, you know?
Is there any discussion of what Mr. Stipa's number and title, Forensic Scientist 2, signify?
I don't believe so, not on the number. And I guess my last point, I was just trying to get across with the Weaver case there. They said that the driver who wanted to talk about the after-accident drinking, the burden on the state is just so little, right? The person's just going to sit there and talk, offer their own testimony about what they did or didn't do when they left the scene and they came back. That's not the same thing of the burdens that would be put on the state to bring in these affidavits and really slow down those wheels of justice to the point where if blood testing and getting these hearings on takes so long, we'll be faced back with the argument of petitioners going, you know what, you took too long. It's a laches argument. You've got to throw this stuff out. That's kind of the two sides of the coin that you have to sort of navigate to, because otherwise, you make one decision, and then over here it's like, well, now it's taken too long. Now we've got to throw them all out because of the time.
In the Joseph matter, since you've kind of gone over there, how do you deal with the stipulation issue?
Right. Well, here I think we have gold standard in the Joseph case. There's never been an issue or a concern that the affidavit of Teresa Sepical wasn't accurate when she came up with the 0.28 blood alcohol that Claudette Joseph had in her system. And under 5320, here it is. She has been qualified in the district court in saying, look, here is my affidavit. What should not have happened really from petitioner's standpoint there was, number one, don't introduce the affidavit if you're only going to complain about it. I mean, it was petitioner who introduced the affidavit in the first place. And you don't want to have to go back and look at a history every single time the person's affidavit does say, I have been qualified. Now it's not even going to be district court, but I've been qualified in the district court. I've been qualified in any court to testify to, blood or drug testing. Otherwise, it's going to be working in every other case in this case, which is what really the district court and Judge Denton did in this matter. knows that the record on appeal is confined, you know, to the record before him, looking at it as a reviewing court saying, what was the evidence presented to the administrative law judge or the DUI adjudicator, not adding to it from lots of outside sources? What did she have to look at that and say, okay, she had exactly what petitioner's counsel in the Kramer matter had, an affidavit that said I was qualified in the district court. I was very surprised to get the decision that said I went back and looked at the matter where she was first qualified. And Judge Herndon, in that case, in that criminal case that qualified Teresa Sepical, it wasn't just a stip and that's it. There was an order that said that she is qualified to testify as to alcohol and controlled substances. It was an affidavit that qualified her now for all purposes. If there was an issue or a question there, I mean, really what should have happened was the district court send it back with directions to the petitioner that says, if you want to do more, you know, you can do more. We'll have it remanded, but it's not. So to sort of do petitioner's homework on appeal was just a really improper procedure. In those cases, pointing the court back to Desert Valley Construction and Gilman, that neither the Supreme Court or the district court may substitute its judgment or evaluation of the record developed at the agency level. So it did more than that because it was going back and looking at things. I mean, it even said I looked at the motion, you know, figured out I'm going to plug this hole, not by sending it back or not by just reviewing what the administrative law judge had before her, but by figuring things out and plugging these holes myself. And that was
let me rephrase the question. The record in Joseph referred to the Proctor case, I believe, as the case in which the individual was qualified. And the argument in front of the district court was that that qualification was based upon a stipulation. Now, the fact that that argument wasn't raised to the ALJ is an interesting question about whether the district court can then look at the Proctor case to determine whether the assertion is correct or not.
Well, then you're always going to have a district court judge reweighing another district court judge's opinion. I mean,
maybe I didn't make my question clear.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You seem to be arguing that the district court judge in a petition for judicial review cannot examine a contention made by a party that the qualification referred to in the Proctor case, which was part of the administrative law judge's record, is invalid. And I'm not sure that we approach judicial review so narrowly.
Let me clarify. Not that the district court judge isn't going to look at all the evidence. They're going to look at certainly everything that's in the record. And the transcript below, absolutely.
Well, let me explain how I'm approaching this, and maybe you can tell me where I'm off base here. The question in the Joseph case is whether 50.320, interpreting the language in the statute, permits the admission of an expert affidavit where the basis of the qualification in the district court was by stipulation. And wasn't it part of, I guess there's two questions. Wasn't it part of the record in front of the ALJ that the qualification occurred by stipulation? And if it wasn't, what precludes the district court judge, when that issue is raised to him or her, from examining the district court record to determine if the qualification was made by stipulation or by litigation?
Okay. Certainly the stipulation in the record, which comes with the order from Judge Herndon, is in the record. And those arguments were made by counsel again in closing argument that's still there about this being a stipulation. He offered it, then he objected to it, in that sense. So certainly Judge Dang can look at that and say, okay, I understand that, what you're saying, that this was done by a stip. But what I have in front of me is Judge Herndon's order. And he said, specifically in his decision, Judge Denton, that a judge's order on a stipulation is not just a rubber stamp, that it's not just any two people could agree to something, that the parties and their attorneys, as officers of the court, he said, were making that representation that this had a basis in law, in fact. And certainly he said Judge Herndon isn't just sitting there with a rubber stamp. He's weighing things that maybe he doesn't, that weren't clear to the record to Judge Denton. He said he doesn't know what all went into that decision. So if there was a question, then that would have to really be sent back to the administrative law judge with directions, probably to petitioner's counsel, to do whatever he thought was missing with respect to that.
But if Judge Denton concludes as a matter of law that qualification of an expert by stipulation does not meet the requirements of 50.320, why would remand be the appropriate remedy? Why couldn't he simply, as he did here, reverse?
Well, it's hard to know what was in his thought process when he was looking at things that the parties and the lawyers weren't privy to, because he went back and pulled the motion that was never made part of any of the district court review or at the administrative level.
But I guess my point is he knows, and the record reveals, that the basis of the suffical qualification was by stipulation. If his conclusion in reviewing that record is that as a matter of law, such a qualification isn't sufficient to meet 50.320, why is remand required as opposed to reversal?
Well, I don't think that that's what he said in his decision about that it wasn't good as a matter of law. It wasn't good as a matter of law after I went through and looked at what I wanted to look at.
Well, the way I read the order, and I really want to get your position here, because I'm not trying to be argumentative, but the way I read his order, he seems to declare in the order that this qualification based on stipulation isn't going to be sufficient under that statute.
And what I would direct the court to do, and Judge Dent has done this in a number of my cases, where, you know, he's a thoughtful judge and he takes it under consideration and then issues a decision, a written decision himself, with directions, I have one now, with directions for the person who's then the prevailer to go ahead and prepare the order. I would direct your honors to, your justices to, back to the decision on pages 132 to...
Well, I'm looking at the decision on line 16, page 5. Of Judge Denton's decision.
Of the decision or the order?
The decision. Where he says, with respect to the argument that admissibility of the declaration could independently stand, the court is not persuaded.
But he was not persuaded, I think, in respect to the same argument that we have in Kramer. That's what I read that to mean, that he wasn't.
Then in the next paragraph he says, all things considered, the court grants the petition for judicial review, as the record does not demonstrate that Suffolk's qualification as an expert by stipulation of the parties in the Proctor case should go beyond that case. Isn't he saying as a matter of law that a stipulation concerning an expert's qualification isn't meeting the test necessary under 50.320? That was the point I wanted to hear you address.
Well, and I guess that's why this is the department's appeal. You know, we don't think that that was a fair reading of it.
So let's go back to the statute itself, 50.320.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is it, it's your position that in reading 50.320 subparagraph 1, and any other person who has qualified in the district court of any county should be read to include a qualification, no matter how they were qualified. As long as the district court judge said, you're qualified, no matter what process was used to reach that conclusion, that's good enough for these cases.
It is.
Okay.
And can I just explain?
And why should we accept that
right.
broader interpretation?
Because we're never going to know what exactly happened on that qualification. You could have a chemist in a criminal case.
Let's stay away from chemists. Let's just stick with the expert who's, there appears to me to be two bases here for qualification. A declaration of a chemist and any other person. So that's what I'm talking about. Any other person who's been qualified. I'm not sure that the statute requires a chemist be qualified by the district court for this statute to apply, but that's not really in front of us.
And anybody else is qualified.
Yeah.
Right. So if you you need to leave it up to the trier of fact that's making those decisions, because you can't go back now, especially since court of record isn't just district court, isn't just the 20-some, I guess, district courts we have here and up north and throughout the state. It's going to be any court of record. Mm-hmm. So you cannot go back and ask, you know, rethink and reweigh what every district court, municipal court, justice court judge is thinking when they have that person in front of them. And you're never going to know what the interplay was between the people that, you know, offered those qualifications up and what objections were made.
But I mean, as to that particular point you're now raising, on page 4 or bait stamp 135 of Judge Stinton's order, he talks about that. He says, we have a motion that was made, but nothing took place. The parties merely stipulated. And he says, I'm not saying the judge couldn't do this, but only as to this case, because he gives no indicia for further use. I'm paraphrasing, but he lays it out.
Right.
Why he has a problem, because the parties just merely stipulated. Nothing was offered. The judge doesn't indicate that he knows the person from prior things, so he has no problem. He's just saying, parties agree, I'll take it. And I won't even get into the assertion made at the beginning of it in terms of you could stipulate that a monkey was qualified.
Right. And he kind of says two things, you know, throughout the order is, no, that's not, we're not talking about a monkey. I mean, you know, you're making, it's not just a judge's rubber stamp, right? I mean, they're doing this. And you could have somebody, you know, maybe you have a case. It's, maybe it's a criminal case where the chemist is brought in and they start to testify and the defense counsel goes, oh, you know what, actually, that's not my issue. Fine. She's qualified, right? I mean, so without knowing what every counsel, two people to the party there, are saying every single time before every single judge, I mean, you're going to have an affidavit that's got a whole history when it gets submitted.
Ms. Waters, I think you make a good point that the ALJ and a reviewing judge shouldn't go back and take a look at contested expert qualification. Here, the question is, when the qualification occurs by stipulation, it's really a narrow point that Mr. Watkins raises. Where the qualification occurs by stipulation, is that enough under the statute? That's what I'm trying to focus on.
It is. It needs to be. It really needs to be. Otherwise, you're opening up, like I said, this can of worms throughout the state on what everybody says. I mean, just because this was a written stipulation, it would be no different than, okay, I'm going to call Ms. Sepical. Ms. Sepical, how are you today? Can you tell me? And the other person goes, no, she's fine. She's fine. You never know if it's going to be one question, 10 questions, a half an hour worth of questioning. You're never going to know.
You're absolutely right. Many times people will say, you don't have to go into all the laying the groundwork for these qualifications. I know this person. I'm satisfied.
You know, that's kind of the point. I think that most of the time, petitioner's counsel, defense counsel, they don't really want the chemist to come down and start asking questions. They just want to be happy that the person didn't show up and hopefully get a dismissal. When the person in these cases, if there was a problem even in the Joseph case, then that would have been up to petitioner's counsel to not only just say, look, this was by a stip, and try and draw some distinction between a stip that's written and a stip that's oral, where you just say, okay, that's fine, but to actually then say, look, let's have her down here. Let's talk it out. That's the purpose of the administrative hearing. Again, it's not just to sit on your hands and then start waving them like crazy when you get up to appellate review.
Well, but if you say that 5275 is an alternative vehicle to the main statute that we're talking about, in other words, you could do an affidavit, but you have to set out the qualifications of the person, why isn't the answer to actually give the person's qualifications and make an attempt in the affidavit to portray that individual as qualified over and above that person's qualification, you know, having been accepted by a court in the state?
Well, with respect to 5275, I mean, that's coming from petitioner's counsel in both these cases. That wasn't from the DMV. The DMV, my argument is under 233B, you get what you need. You take the evidence that is reasonable. What a reasonable and prudent person is going to be relying on. Under 275, I think that is more narrowly tailored to the discretion of the trier of fact to ferret out if this person has enough, either because I know that they have enough, because they've submitted an affidavit that says in the Suffolk case, you know, I'm qualified.
Right, what their education is, what their experience is, what they know about this testing process. Why is that not simply the solution to this?
Well, I mean, that would be, you know, going back to sort of changing 5320 in this Suffolk case,
yeah,
right? I mean, it's saying that that's no longer going to be good enough when that statute over time has gotten, you know, broader and broader and broader to include, you know, all sorts of people that can make up the definition of a chemist to make it not just district court, any court of record. I mean, it's getting broader and broader to promote the liberal construction of the implied consent statutes, which has been said time and time and time again, as I'm sure you're all aware, to have that liberal reading to get the main goal of what the driver's license revocation cases are all about. Not your criminal cases, I understand there's more protections there. But here, what are the burdens of the procedure? I mean, in Weaver, it was like, okay, let the guy talk. That's not taking much. But to then put more burdens upon the procedural due process is going to slow it down and not effectuate keeping Nevada's highways safe. And when you get right down to it, that's it. I mean, if there's really an issue with any particular chemist, get them down here. Let's talk about it. Let's get it out there. I mean, that's the whole point of a trier of fact in this discussion. But where it's not, and it's like, no, we're just going to really not trying to, you know, talk about it. We just want to get the hook up. That's not enough. That's not enough here, because otherwise you're back to, like you said, 5320 must come in. It says you're qualified, must come in. That's what the statute says. And the ALJ in the Kramer case is saying, look, you know, I understand it says that, and where it doesn't, that doesn't mean it's out. It means if you don't have any problems, it's going to come in. And if you do have a problem, let's get it sorted out. But we all want to get the same thing. Give the due process to the driver, absolutely, minimal standards of due process to a fair hearing, and then protect the people that drive on this state's highways. I think the only thing I haven't touched on, if you have any questions for me, because I do think it's an important issue from the two-hour rule back in Kramer, is and Mr. Watkins did talk about a little bit of things that I was not privy to in the criminal case about when he was arrested, because that's not in this record below. That was the first time I heard about that, actually it was just today. So that part is not in the record to look at. However, when you look at the 2 hours and 13 minutes, the cases have said, even criminal cases, that if there is a two-hour rule in a criminal case, and it's a little bit more, then it goes to the wait. It comes in and it goes into the wait. Is it a 5 hour or is it 2 hours and 13 minutes like it was in Kramer? And the Hyatt reading, and I just wanted to kind of point that out, what it said, was really limiting to, we're not going to find that you have to establish a blood alcohol concentration at the time of driving. But it didn't say you have to do it within 2 hours. And that was sort of in Weaver, I think that there was a misinterpretation of Kramer, and Mr. Watkins, I know, is aware of this as well, where they said a driver under this criminal statute, a driver may be convicted for DUI if he's under the influence or has been found to have it within 2 hours. A blood alcohol of point at the time 0.10 while driving is thus not a prerequisite for a revocation of a driver's license. Respondents' contention that the legislature intended to revoke only the license pursuant to 0.10 while driving lacks merit. But they didn't say at all in Hyatt that it had to be within the 2 hours. And they go into quite a nice discussion about those differences between the criminal side and the administrative side. And then when you get back to the administrative side, you look at 484.387 and 484.384, which talks about, now it's 0.08, at the time of the test. The scope of the hearing is limited to whether the person at the time of the test had a blood alcohol of 0.08 or more. When Justice Hardesty, you asked about the in the affidavit, I think you're referring to, the chemist's affidavit, but it's the nurse's affidavit that actually establishes the time. So from the time that the person is then, you know, brought in to when the actual blood is drawn, once it's drawn and captured, it's drawn and captured. Mm-hmm. But that was by the nurse and not the chemist. So the chemist would never refer to that particular time. That would come from the nurse's part of it. So with that,
what's the evidence in the record that establishes the blood alcohol content of Kramer within the two-hour period?
Well, I mean, there isn't. The two-hour period isn't, it's a red herring in an administrative case. It's not necessary. It's only at the time of the test. But when you look at what the length of time was to get to the 2 hours and 13 minutes, it's the when the blood was withdrawn from the nurse, by the nurse, and when the officer testified of when he had Kramer there, which he said 7:05 hours. He said it's around that. So when you look at that, and this is a kid at the time, he was 21, banged into a bunch of cars in a parking lot and took off. So to the extent that there was lag time, he created the lag time. And that's not the purpose of this, you know, structure, to give encouragement to people to flee the scene, to try and lengthen that 2 hours. What used to happen on some of the cases that Mr. Watkins referred to, I think in his brief, was back in 95, you could refuse. So you would try and refuse and not be around and dilly-dally to get it out. But you can't refuse now. It's going to be a forced blood withdrawal. So I don't want this court to be left with the impression that that's a serious thing to encourage drunk drivers to leave the scene.
Sure. Are there any other questions for Ms. Waters? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Watkins, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Justice. First off, I would like to point out in the Joseph case that the administrative law judge did have the stipulation that was all part of the record. So it was not something that was added later. That was all part of the administrative record. And clearly, I think I would be derelict. And by the way, I direct, in this case, Mr. Connors, who's now working for the Department of Motor Vehicles. But I go through and sit down and say this is the way we need to handle this particular case. And I just think it would be inappropriate not to provide the evidence before the hearing. Also, I'm a little upset about this waiver type argument. I know you don't see a waiver here, and there wasn't a waiver. First off, you have to know how the DMV hearings operated for the last 30 years. You got onto the Department of Motor Vehicles, and then, by the way, George Foley many years ago filed a case that was the Thompson case, where he said, wait a minute, there's a problem here. There's nobody from the AG's office down there. The hearing officer is directing the whole show. Personally, I think there's a problem with that. But Thompson said, well, all the hearing officer did was just identify the exhibits and mark them and then introduce them, and then would say to the police officer, would you tell me what happened? And that was it. And it used to be if they didn't go through and say they did this, the DMV did not prevail. So in what happens at the DMV, they introduce and talk about the exhibits. They don't introduce them in evidence. They just identify them, the hearing officer. At the end of the testimony, that's when we then object to the admissibility. And in this case, if you look at the record, and I made a big deal about this, that in the record it shows that the exhibits were not admitted. They were when Mr. Conner was arguing, they had not been admitted. So there's no waiver, and there's no sitting on your hands or anything like that. So with that,
well, I didn't want to infuse my own personal experience in this when I did this about 15 years ago, but it sounds like the process is similar.
Yes. So there was no waiver. For the last, since I've been a lawyer, there's always been a requirement if you're going to use a document in lieu of live testimony at the Department of Motor Vehicles or anywhere, that there had to be a showing that the person had the qualifications. And the legislature made it very clear under 50.320 that the person be qualified as for at least first qualified, one time, that's it, just a one-time qualification, then that would be sufficient to keep them away from the hearing and they would be able to use an affidavit. In this case, what the Department of Motor Vehicles is wanting everyone to do is just ignore the qualifications, that human element that comes into testing, any scientific testing, in this case, the blood testing. So we cannot ignore that. And for the past 30 years that I've been a lawyer, there's always been that requirement. We just can't waive, okay, that kind of a requirement. The law is very clear on that particular point. And they did not put anything in their documentation to establish that this person was, in fact, qualified. And again, on the Suffolk, if you looked at that document, it sounds as though she's qualified. It just so happened that I do my research and found out how, and I don't believe that that was a sufficient qualification, and neither did Judge Denton, and neither should this court. So I'm asking in the Kramer case that you reverse that case and then you uphold the Joseph case.
So is it your position that you could not qualify a witness in an affidavit other than by under 5320. In other words, if you went through the whole litany of the qualifications in the affidavit and said, I am this and I have these expert qualifications and here's where I trained and here's what I've read and here's the peer testing and on, your point is even that would not do if that person had never been qualified in a contested hearing by a district court judge to opine on blood alcohol.
Justice, let me say this, if I may. First off, that in the record, there was none of that. There was no qualification.
I understand
whatsoever.
That. Yeah.
And in honesty, which I will always be to everyone, I would object to a, quote, hearsay document, an affidavit declaration, that does not meet the requirement of 50.320. Because 50.320 is a specific statute, and it, in fact, tells what is required. And if that's not done, then that person should come in. So I don't want to stand here and say, well, yeah, you could do that. I would argue that you couldn't do that.
But in this case, they can't come in.
Yeah, because it's a specific statute. And therefore, this argument, and I don't want to get too far into this, but the argument that affidavits can be used under the administrative code, it doesn't mean that every affidavit can be used, it only legal affidavits. But I don't need to get there. I want to stay clear with the issues. There was no qualification here. 5320 wasn't satisfied. And Judge Denton, who is a very diligent judge, doesn't always make the right decision, but he did in this case. Thank you very much. next time I'll be out there arguing he didn't know what he was doing. So. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Poor old Judge Denton keeps getting me.
Oh, one last thing I'd like to say, and I think Justice Douglas mentioned the 233B-135. It talks about the hearing officer's responsibility to, in fact, make lawful procedures and no abuse of discretion, et cetera, and that's all set forth, you know, in the judicial review requirement, and therefore Kramer should be reversed on that basis, and Joseph should be upheld. Thank you very much.
Mr. Watkins, Ms. Waters, this panel very much appreciates your briefs and your arguments this morning.